You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, stem cell researchers from around the world are convening in Madison next week for a symposium. We'll learn about what Wisconsin scientists are bringing to the table.
First, chances are you've heard or seen a commercial like this in the past few years.
At Globe University, we believe in preparing career-focused, community-minded graduates for the global workforce. We do this by providing industry-designed curriculum centered on real-world experience and application. We offer associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctorate degrees, as well as diploma and certificate programs. With over 130 years' experience, we've streamlined our programs to get you on the job as quickly as possible. As a student, you will experience a staff and faculty who care about your success and call you by name, not number. Globe University is accredited by the Accrediting Council for Independent Colleges and Schools.
The for-profit college industry has grown tremendously in the past few decades, both in classroom and virtual settings. Proponents say that they are a valuable resource for students who don't perform well in traditional settings and that they provide needed workers for a variety of industries.
But critics say that they prey on students with few other options and who don't have the support system to allow them to get into or succeed in four-year colleges. And that because they are in business to earn money for shareholders, the students suffer.
Tressie McMillan-Cottom worked in enrollment at two for-profit colleges. After experiencing the kinds of choices students faced, she left the for-profit educational sector to go study it in graduate school. She's now an assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. She joins us now to talk about her new book, Lower Ed: The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. Tressie, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me here at Central Time.
Well, as we mentioned, for-profit colleges have expanded tremendously in the past two decades. What conditions and public policies account for that growth?
That's a great question, because I think that's actually the question. It's not so much that everybody woke up in around 1995 and 1996 and decided that they all just wanted to go to college, right? That something usually has happened when you see that sort of mass enrollment, change in enrollment behaviors. And my argument is that a few things happened. The first thing that happened is that the labor market became a little less hospitable to people who didn't have a college degree. Right, is actually not that hospitable for people who have a college degree, but it's really inhospitable for those who do not. And increasingly what people were experiencing is that without a college degree, they could not get a foothold into an occupational path that would allow them to move up over their career and lifetime. What had once been typical for workers, which was that you would get a job, work with an employer, maybe two or three over your lifetime, but that over time, your pay and salary and status at work would increase over time, right? That sort of social contract had really changed. Increasingly, what employers were saying to workers was that, listen, we not only won't promise you job security or pay or job quality into your older years, we won't even guarantee that next year, right? That we increasingly needed to be individually responsible for making sure that we were always career ready, because increasingly we will always need to be looking for the next job as employers downshift labor to manage costs in the short term. So workers were feeling that, right? That makes people feel really insecure. On the flip side of that, social policy didn't have a response. Right, so both of these things are happening, sort of a squeeze in the labor market and then a vacuum among social policy. On the social policy side, a couple of things did happen, and then lots of things that probably should have happened didn't happen. One thing that happened for the poorest workers, those that sort of dance along the line of being poor, so, you know, might dip below the poverty level one year, sort of get a better job in the next and be above it or right at it, that kind of sort of cycling in and out of poverty, which is actually quite common. Those workers were finding that social policy benefits like the story at the top of your hour, things like food subsidies, were becoming much more difficult to obtain, lots of new rules to obtain them, and they were becoming more hostile to helping poor people as states tried to manage the cost of those programs. So those things that had been put in place as a safety net for poorer workers were becoming increasingly frayed. At the same time, we did not see any social policy to help workers, right, to help them manage things like the rising cost of health care or the rising cost of education. So at the same time that workers are feeling really, really insecure, the social safety net is fraying and changing, and people are trapped there in the middle. And the only response that we've been willing to give them from both a federal and a state policy level is, oh, you need to go to college, right? Mm-hmm. College will solve this problem for you. Well, when college becomes the only solution for millions of people, millions of people try to figure out the most efficient way to do college and to try to do it the sort of easiest, most direct route possible. And what for-profit colleges really figured out early on was, oh, that's what will sell people, a very direct route to job security that promises them that they'll always be career ready. They just have to sign on the dotted line.
And so, Tressie, you talk quite a bit in your book, Lower Ed, about how the people that you were encountering when you were a recruiter and enrollment person for first a beauty college and then a technical college were people that really just didn't have the kind of structures in place that other people mm-hmm. who might go to a four-year college would. Right. Can you give us an example of the kind of folks that were coming through the door?
Sure. So the beauty school in many ways represented those smaller for-profit college chains that were mostly local or regional schools that every community has. So not just the beauty school, but things like the auto mechanic school, those sorts of short-term occupational certificates. Those students were much more likely to be African-American, Hispanic, working poor, or poor. They were also more likely to be women. And for all of the reasons that are related to what we know in how inequality works in our society, those people had very few of the sort of social supports to help make them successful in college. The number one thing that they didn't have was that they were less likely to have attended a really competitive or well-resourced, well-supported K through 12 school. Well, we know that matters a lot, right? If you go to a poor K through 12 school, you tend to graduate with sort of all of the inequalities that were baked into your K through 12 experience. And those students tend to be less likely to be prepared for going on to what we call a traditional college experience. On the other side of that was the technical school, which offered sort of higher level degrees, bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, et cetera. And those students were more likely to be male than the students at the beauty school, a little less likely to be African American and Hispanic, and almost all of those students were working while they were going to school. So for those students, it was a different type of inequality. Their inequality was that they may have had some preparation for college, but not enough preparation for a competitive college education. And the biggest thing they didn't have is they didn't have the income or the family support, which is just really, you know, a proxy for wealth when you have family members who can help, you know, sort of smooth over the rough edges of your life. That's usually a function of wealth. And so if you don't come from a family that was wealthy, what they couldn't afford to do is they couldn't afford to quit their job to pursue a traditional college education. So even though their scenario was a little better off than the students at the beauty school, those students were still experiencing some inequalities.
We're talking with Tressie McMillan-Cottom right now. She is the author of Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. So let's break this down, Tressie. How do for-profit colleges make their money?
Well, they make their money almost unilaterally from tuition. Tuition is their, for most for-profit colleges, sort of their singular source of revenue. The larger corporately controlled for-profit college chains, the ones with the big national name brands that we really recognize, things like the University of Phoenix and Strayer and ITT and Capella, those brands distribute that money to corporate shareholders. But even the privately owned for-profit colleges are doing what we call extracting profit from revenue, tuition money, to pay to private owners. So what we see, since the majority of for-profit college students, something like 97% of them, rely on federal student aid programs to pay their tuition, what you see is that for-profit colleges are almost a one-to-one extraction tool. They extract money from the federal student aid system and then distribute it to either shareholders or private owners as revenue or profit. So they make their money from tuition. So the only way they can be more profitable year over year is to do one of two things. They can make education less expensive to provide, right? So they can provide cheaper education, or they can increase the price of tuition. And either way, for students, that's not usually a very good scenario.
And what do we know about the graduation rates in those for-profit college programs compared to the more traditional college programs?
Mm-hmm. We know that students who attend for-profit colleges are less likely to graduate than students who have similar characteristics who attend traditional colleges. We know that when they do drop out, that they have more student loan debt than if they'd attended a not-for-profit college or university. We know that even of the students who finish, and again, the majority of those who enroll in a for-profit college won't finish, but even among those who do, we find that when they try to go to work, they are more likely to be unemployed. When they're unemployed for longer. And when they do secure employment, don't earn demonstrably more than someone who does not have a degree. So from the point of dropping out, the college dropout rates are pretty abysmal, and it's actually probably the biggest sort of problem, I think, with whether or not for-profit colleges are a good public investment for us. But I say you have to compare the worst-case scenario, which is, for us, the high dropout rates and the debt load that students carry in the for-profit college sector, and say, well, okay, well, maybe that's worth it if the best-case scenario is really good, right? And the best-case scenario, even in the for-profit college sector, is actually not so good. And so when you have a pretty low worst-case scenario and then a not-so-good best-case scenario, the for-profit college sector, I argue, becomes one that's really defined by being high risk.
Tressie McMillan-Cottom worked for two different for-profit colleges before she decided to study the industry as a graduate student and now as an assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. She's with us to discuss her new book, Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you attended a for-profit college like University of Phoenix, Globe University, Madison Media Institute, DeVry University, or others? What was the experience like for you? Did you get what you needed out of the program? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation now with Tressie McMillan-Cottom. She combines her personal experiences and academic research in her new book, Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy.
And we want to hear from you. Have you attended a for-profit college? And if you finished the program, how would you rate how much it improved your life and the life of your family, considering the costs involved? If you didn't finish the program, what happened? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Tressie, I want to go back to your experience actually working for the for-profit colleges and what made you leave there. You were first at the beauty college, then at the technical college. And what was it like being a recruiter for the technical college?
Being a recruiter at the technical college was defined by, the thing that comes to mind when I try to, remember the experience of it was the sense of time, right? It was a very fast-paced job. And even when there wasn't a lot to do in my daily tasks, there was a lot of pressure for everything to be done very quickly. It was a very quick job. And in many ways, that relationship to time, how fast could we make the enrollment process? How quickly could we convert prospective students to enrolled students so that they could become a tuition-generating student? All of that for me was about how much the process of enrolling students at the technical college was about speeding it up. Right. So when you would call like a 1-800 number after hearing one of the ads about how to change your life today, someone like me at the time would have answered the phone on the other end. And my number one job when I picked up that phone was to first of all get your contact information so that I could make sure I had a way to get in touch with you, but then also make sure I could get you to come visit the campus as soon as possible, not in a week, not in 2 weeks, you know, not during fall visitation day, something that those of us at traditional colleges might feel familiar with, but to get you to come visit today or maybe tomorrow, at the latest 2 days from now, right? Because the idea was to try to capture people in the moment when they were feeling sort of the most insecure, the most vulnerable, and perhaps the most committed to the idea of thinking about school, and I needed to talk to you in that moment. And next week, 2 weeks was really far too long when I considered how fast people's lives were when they were complicated by things like childcare and work and caring for parents and all of those things that are very common for for-profit college students. And so my job was about, you know, really trying to make that process happen as quickly as possible. So there were lots of pressures from both above management and below the students to make that process as seamless and as fast as possible.
Let's go to the phones, and we'll start with Mark in Wauwatosa. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
Well, I was relating my experience. I actually had taught at one of the for-profit colleges. I won't name the college, but I went through grad school, and while I was in grad school, had an opportunity to teach a couple, 100-level, 400-level classes in the conventional college, and I found myself having to dumb down the curriculum, and we were encouraged to not fail people that needed help or that perhaps, you know, weren't really coming along the way they should. And so I spent a lot of extra time myself personally just, you know, regrading papers and spending office hour time that I had. You know, I was used to doing that in the conventional college, but when it came to the for-profit college, it seemed that, you know, the most important thing was to pass the students so that, you know, they could collect the money. And then there weren't really a lot of deviations from the, from the curriculum. Being an environmental person, I was actually, you know, I took one of my classes on a field trip, kind of a hands-on thing. It was a great learning experience from the student's perspective, but there really wasn't a lot of, I don't want to say attaboy, but there wasn't really a lot of appreciation for, you know, for doing a little bit extra. That was a real, true learning experience. So,
thanks for that call, Mark. And Tressie, does Mark's experience sound familiar to you?
I'm so happy to hear from Mark. First of all, thanks for calling, Mark. It's always great to hear from people who have taught within for-profit colleges. They don't actually figure that prominently in my book just because there was so much other stuff I needed to talk about. But I love that Mark gives me a chance to talk about that very thing. Yes, his experience is quite typical for a couple of reasons. So one thing he mentioned was the sort of pressure, and sometimes not direct, but the indirect and the direct pressure to sort of pass students along. Well, one of the reasons why this happens in the for-profit college sector is, remember those inequalities we talked about in the K-12 system mm-hmm. that produces a lot of students that aren't always ready for college-level work. Well, one of the things that traditional colleges have done, especially public higher education, is invested a lot of money in what we call remedial courses. Right? Those are those courses you take to get you up to speed for things like college-level writing and college-level math. Well, everybody hates them, and of course you do, right? Because they're hard, and the students, you know, struggle in them, and they take a lot of resources, but they're valuable, right? This is one of the ways that college sort of supports the education mission of public education K-12 by providing that service. In for-profit colleges, because those courses are so expensive to provide and because the student consumer doesn't like taking them because they are difficult, for-profit colleges tend not to either offer them or they certainly don't offer them at the beginning when the student begins school. And so what you see instead is this incentive to make sure students are enjoying their college experience, right, so that they keep showing up and so that we keep getting the tuition payments on their behalf. So there's a profit motive there to making sure the students enjoy school. Well, the problem is when enjoyment is in conflict with making sure they get their skills up to speed for college-level work. And that's actually quite common across for-profit colleges. One executive said to me in our interview when we talked about that, they said, well, yeah, you know, you got to hook them with the enjoyable stuff first. So we don't front-load, you know, the remedial courses because it's too discouraging for students. They drop out. And if they drop out too soon, then you don't get the full tuition payment for them from the federal government, right? So that's the profit motive. And then the other thing Mark talked about that came up with lots of teachers that I know who have worked in the for-profit college sector is how little control they have over the curriculum. One of the hallmarks of traditional higher education is something that we call faculty governance, right? And that's the idea that your professors have pretty much, you know, control over how they will design the course and teach it within some guidelines. That is actually not the case in for-profit colleges, and that is by design. So when you read all of the financial documents, for example, of the corporate for-profit colleges, they talk a lot about, oh, well, we don't have to worry about paying our faculty a lot to develop curriculum, which would be an expense, which would cut into revenue, which would cut into profit. We develop all of our curriculum at a central office, and then we ship it out to people like Mark, and we just have him teach it the way that we've written it. And so, yes, that's by design to keep the labor cost of teaching in the for-profit college sector low so that you can increase how much profit you can extract.
Well, Tressie, there's so much in your book that I wanted to get to, but unfortunately we are out of time. So thank you so much for being with us today. You have a really unique perspective on this.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and it's wonderful to talk to you today.
Tressie McMillan-Cotton is the author of Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy.